Hello and welcome to Learn With Us. Today I'm with Chris Moomba, who's a friend of mine I've known for several years. How's it going today, buddy, in sunny England?
Yeah, good to catch up with you again, Nikos. It's been a while. Weather's been nice for a few days, but it's back to how it usually is. So stuck indoors today, but that's fine.
So Chris originally messaged me after I think I did some LinkedIn thing offering to train developers, and I was working as a contractor in Acton, London, or thereabouts, and he messaged me just saying that he was getting interested in programming and we'd be able to meet up for a coffee or something, and then we'd be met up. Is that more like what's the story?
Yeah, so I'd been recruiting for quite a few years, and at the same time, over a period, you know, speaking to developers, I started to develop an interest myself in programming. So I noticed a message from Nikos on LinkedIn saying that he was interested in mentoring people like myself. So I just reached out to him, and we met up for a coffee, and we've kept in touch since.
Yeah, so what did you think of my approach when we basically, I didn't actually talk to you much at the shop. I just says, bring your laptop, and then I just set up your laptop for GitHub and WebStorm and everything like that.
Yeah, I remember. I remember the day really well. It was good. I think that you just try to set me up with the minimum things that a developer needs, and I remember I found a lot of it quite confusing at the time, because there's a big jump from being a hobbyist to an actual professional developer, so it was a lot to take in, but it was good as well. Good stuff.
Yeah, I basically taught you. I showed you WebStorm, and I taught you Git in about half an hour. I didn't actually explain what I was doing. I just says create a GitHub account, and I set up the WebStorm, and I pushed and pulled on that. So this is how you do pull requests, merge requests. But the reason I did that is partly because like I was very busy that day. Obviously, I was just doing it in my lunch hour. And also that a lot of these times, these things can be very hard to understand if you try and explain it without actually showing someone how to do it. So I just found that if I just threw this at you, then if you were keen, you probably wouldn't be scared enough to... I've done that before with people, and I have scared them away, but I just thought, you know, if someone has got the drive to sit and self-taught programming, me being very... very sort of forceful and showing them how to do it won't scare them away, and it'll just get them along the process faster, in a sense.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where if you rely on someone to explain everything to you, you know, it will take forever, you know, so you definitely have to have some drive to do some research yourself, to experiment yourself. So while I didn't understand everything that you showed me, I was able to get the gist of it and look into some things on my side as well.
What sort of things were you building at that time?
So at the time I was really trying to get my first job. So I was, just putting together a small portfolio, more or less. So like, a simple blog, like a simple personal website, things where I would use an API of some sort. I knew that I was mainly interested on the front end side of things, and I was using Angular 1. I think it's Angular 1 point something at the time. I was just doing some basic front end. JavaScripty stuff to build a portfolio.
So, in a sense, were you looking at Angular 1 before learning how vanilla JavaScript works?
It was a bit of both, really. I think there is actually quite a lot to learn, and if you don't really have a mentor, you're not really engaged with real people in the community, it can be a bit tricky to work out what order to learn things in. So I definitely did some vanilla JavaScript, but I wouldn't really say I built anything of note in vanilla JavaScript. Like, I moved into frameworks and pretty quickly, probably too soon, but you know, maybe it wasn't the optimal thing to do. But you know, you see this new shiny popular framework that everyone's using, and I just wanted to get involved as well. So
before you met me, how long were you actually trying to teach yourself programming, web development?
I can't remember the exact date we met, but I would guess maybe a year and a half. Maybe a year and a half ago, I'd first started.
Yeah.
Like, just kind of looking at online tutorials and stuff and playing around with it. And bear in mind, I had a full-time job.
Yeah.
As well, so everything takes longer. And technology moves. So I think when I first started, I was looking at Ruby on Rails. That was kind of my first introduction to programming. And then I made a decision to move into front end and JavaScript. And the technology kept on changing.
Totally. Happens all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it was really important for me actually to be able to get a job so that I could focus on it full time, because it was pretty hard to keep up, just doing a little bit after a long day in recruitment.
So, on average, how many hours per week were you devoting to the self-study?
I'd say maybe between one and 2 hours a day during the week, Monday to Friday. Maybe like three or 4 hours a day on the weekend, but you know, mm-hmm. sometimes it'll be more than that, sometimes it'll be a lot less, you know.
Yeah.
I had a bit more free time back then, so I could manage that.
I wish I could have been there right at the start to guide you, but then again, I would have probably blasted you to the moon and back. Because we have this problem called like institutional blindness or cursive mm-hmm. learning. Mm-hmm. It's hard for us because we basically live in a place where we're doing it all day long.
Yeah.
It's like, how can this person not understand what a variable is and all this stuff? And I remember when I was first at university and I was learning programming for the first time. I mean, it was completely confusing to me, and it was only like Java, and it took me several months to understand what a class actually was.
Yeah. I mean, I remember that day that we met, and you were showing me WebStorm, and in fact I was using was it VS Code or maybe Sublime Text, and you were trying to like jump to, like, you know, when you jump through definitions, right, on like WebStorm, like you just I don't know, command and click on a Mac just to go into view a method or whatever, and you was like, oh, why doesn't that work, what's wrong? It's like, all right, you know what, and you told me to get WebStorm basically.
Yeah.
And I never really understood it back then, but now I think at the place I'm at, we use IntelliJ, and we're similar to WebStorm, right? Same company, right? And it's pretty amazing. So I understand the benefits now. It's hard to know what you need unless you've done it, basically, you know. And I also remember when I was learning in JavaScript, what did I find tricky? I found it hard to get my head around closures. Like, I just couldn't really.
For sure.
It just seems so strange.
But
I think at some other point, I managed to get my head around the core stack, and that made other things easier to learn. And that's another thing, right? It's like sometimes trying to learn one thing without another, it can be really challenging. So
yeah, a closure is something that I never really came across in other programming languages like Java, assembly language, PHP. Mm-hmm. It was just this sort of single-threaded JavaScript thing that it's something you can't just learn by reading literature. You have to actually work with these things, otherwise you'll just never pick it up.
Yeah, for sure. And after a while of after a period of working with it, you don't really think about it. You don't really have to think about it too much. I work with React now, and that is one of my favorite frameworks because, it's not a framework, it's a library, but it has given me more exposure to some of these things. Maybe not so much closures, but things like classes, this bindings and things like that, where if you haven't worked with vanilla JavaScript extensively, it's a good route into learning about that kind of thing. So
yeah,
not everything you can learn in a book, basically. You can read it in a book, but to understand it, you just have to like play around and experiment and fail quite a lot. So
nothing goes out of date quicker than JavaScript books.
Yeah. I haven't bought a book in a long time, actually, because they just go out of date so quickly.
My first JavaScript book I bought was they actually made a 3D game using HTML tables, and the tables were the actual, and it was just, why is this in a book? Why am I paying money for the book that has a 3D version of some clone of some, 3D game, like going through tunnels and that stuff, and it's in HTML tables, and that code is just not going to be very portable, and it's just a technical exercise.
Yeah. I think I've managed to avoid HTML tables. But that sounds quite painful. I mean, when you're learning, I know you're asking the questions, but when you're learning these days, like, I guess you don't read books anymore, do you? Do you just like look at the documentation?
Yeah, well, it depends if I have access to an online book or not. Mm-hmm. Documentation is, of course, useful if you're on like a new framework like Svelte. I tend to just want to go straight to examples because I don't really have the patience to read pages of documentation, which is one of my flaws, I guess. But I like to just go through examples and then... but if the framework's clever enough and good enough, then normally you don't have to worry too much about reading all the docs. Like, I just found Svelte very intuitive by reading the docs and the inline examples and sort of mixed, sort of hybrid.
Cool.
Also, I like to have good documentation within the code. Some people like to generate docs from the code, so they sort of have a separate web page and stuff, but I prefer just to have the examples in line with JS docs in the actual source code. And also sometimes if you have TypeScript, it saves you a lot of time learning what parameters to pass around. But TypeScript's sort of like you want to use TypeScript when the project is of sort of significant complexity. Otherwise it's just sort of too much of a extra hit on just complexity.
Okay. Yeah, I've not used TypeScript much, but yeah, sounds really cool.
So going back to memory lane, when we met for that first time in the, it was probably Starbucks, and you graciously got me coffee in the snack bars, which is normally my requirement for a 1 hour of mentoring. What happened after that? How long was it before you got a job? That kind of stuff.
I think it may have been another 6 to 8 months or so.
That's good.
Before I started applying for jobs. In some ways, I actually wish that I started applying sooner, because it's not until you actually apply that you kind of get a better idea of what employers are looking for. Sure. Whereas I was kind of in this bubble of, I had in my head what I thought I needed to get a job. I had these ideas about what I needed to do and what I needed to add to my portfolio. But it wasn't until I started applying for jobs and getting some feedback from employers that I kind of realized, okay, this is more important than that sort of thing.
Yeah, the barrier to entry is often a lot higher than the actual job requirements. Like, you'll never be in such a stressful situation in a job as the interview. And once you're in the job, you can sort of just go at like a normal pace, good enough pace, and people normally don't breathe down your neck so much.
Yeah, I think so. I think especially as a junior, just kind of working out what to know, because I remember at the time there were some jobs that required that had like tricky technical tests, and other jobs, job interviews which were more portfolio based and more kind of like question and answer types, general knowledge, JavaScript, that sort of thing. And because I was like kind of studying this, learning dev part time, it was really tricky actually to kind of work out, you know, okay, where should I spend my time? Should I spend my time practicing algorithms, or should I be building my portfolio? And it was pretty hard to work out. But I think in the end, I just focused a bit more on building websites because it was a bit more practical.
Yeah, I'm just looking at our emails. I'm just trying to remember what you asked me a few questions. I think we met up in Starbucks again. Mm-hmm. I think I was always telling you to keep learning React as well.
Yep, I remember that.
Yeah. I think it's really encouraging because you're probably one of the one or two people that I've actually seen go through a process of becoming a programmer or not. And a lot of people, so many people that you just wouldn't imagine. I've tried to get to learn, and then they just give up, and it's actually discouraged me quite a lot from trying to teach people programming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that you have to be self-driven, but you have to enjoy it. You know, I think sometimes people might think, there's a lot of money in programming. I don't want to do this and get paid lots of money. But, you know, I think, for me personally, money isn't really a great motivator, you know. I mean, yes, all right, I need to get paid and things, but it for me has never kind of able to give me the kind of sustained motivation to do something like to be a programmer, you know.
Yeah.
In programming, you're learning all the time, you know, like if you want to stay up to date, you know, if you want to stay relevant. And I genuinely think it's something you have to enjoy, and if you don't enjoy it, you're gonna have a bit of a hard time. And also as well, like that initial period of just trying to learn how to solve problems, you know, I think that's one of the kind of biggest hurdles to overcome, just learning how to think about the job. Because in many jobs you have to solve a problem of some sort, but learning how to think like a programmer and how to break problems down into small tasks and stuff, like until you get that, it can be quite tricky.
Yeah.
I can imagine it's hard to teach someone that.
If you don't mind me asking, what age were you when you first started to learn to code in this recruitment kind of business?
I was 28, I think. I was 28.
Yeah.
So, fairly late. I wish I'd done it sooner, but it wasn't really something I thought about as a job.
Well, 28, you're still able to sort of, your brain's still developing in a sense, so you can sort of do that. I think, I'm not sure in science, but I know you're certainly moldable.
Yeah. You can definitely learn it. And I think it was a good time for me because I still had the free time to do it. I think if I'd left it much later, it would have been hard to put together the free time to do a career shift like that.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I did it when I could do it.
So I reckon a lot of people listening to this podcast are probably people that are not programmers, this particular episode, because, or maybe some software developers are listening to it, but for people out there, like my listener, that are thinking, I would like to be a programmer, but this idea of failing to become, you know, to go all the way and make a decision, I just want to try and be real with people that are listening so that they don't get a false expectation of how easy this is. It's sort of imagine a game where you have about 2 years ahead of you, or a path to get to the final level where you complete the game, and during all that time you've got this sort of long battle. It's sort of like that with, if your goal is to become a programmer, then you're probably talking about 1 or 2 years of self-study if you're if you're doing it part-time to get good enough to get a junior job position, because you know you're competing against people that are coming out of uni that have done it for 4 years. It's not going to be easy, but
yeah,
if you do enjoy it, then that's probably one of the first flags that I would, green flag, I'd say, yeah, this is maybe something for you. If you quit, then that's it, you've failed, right? You've failed the task. But if you don't quit, eventually this stuff's going to sink in, and everybody learns at different paces. There's a big spectrum in skill ranges of programmers. There's some that are probably 10 times quicker. And I've met people like that, and I'm like, sheesh, you know. So it's okay to be average. It's okay to be below average as well, because I really hate it when a lot of adverts saying you want this rock star developer or the top 3% it means everyone else is just not good enough. If you're good enough to get the job done and you're providing value to the company, the value is more than they're paying for you, in a sense, because no one's going to pay you what you're worth, otherwise what's the point of that? They're going to make sure what you're generating makes them more money. So it's okay to be a below average developer to learn slow, even 2 or 3 times slower than other developers, as long as you're good enough to get the work done in the part of the team, then that's fine. I remember talking to a tech lead, and I was talking to him about all this stuff about rockstar developers and superstar developers, and he's just saying, like, I don't really care about that. As long as you're good enough, it's good enough for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you do hear that word thrown around a lot, you know, rockstar developer, 10x engineer. And I think for sure, like, you know, there's some developers are better than others. You know, some people have been programming since they were teenagers, you know, or playing with computers since they were teenagers and doing it for longer than you. I think if you get obsessed about that or too worried about what other people are doing, then, you know, it's not really going to help you. I think you just need to focus on, is this something that I enjoy doing? Is this something that I kind of look forward to doing? Am I still curious about it? And do I still want to get better at this thing? I think if you're too worried about where other people are at, it's not really going to help your progress. But like for sure, like I can appreciate there's like a wide range of skill in this industry, you know, from people like me who are mainly using frameworks and maybe doing a bit of vanilla JS on the side, to the people who actually like making a lot of the tools that programmers are using. You know, like there's some really amazing devs out there, and I can appreciate what they bring without being too distracted, I think.
Yeah, there's excuse me. I think if a team has good leadership, then the code base can be made sufficiently simple that a junior developer or maybe a less skilled developer is able to contribute to the code base in a financially profitable way to the company. And what I've seen a lot of times is a lot of code bases are so complicated that it needs a team of only senior developers to do the tasks, because it takes them so long to do the tasks that a junior guy would basically have no hope. Or guy or girl, sorry, I mean.
Yeah.
If a task is simple enough, then the difference in speed between a junior and a senior is not that large. You know, if it's something like, you know, mocking up HTML and CSS and just some basic framework integration stuff, if the task is simple enough, the senior developer isn't going to be that much faster than the junior person. So we don't all have to be these rockstar developers to make the team's work. As long as the senior senior leader is good enough to make the code simple enough that everybody can contribute profitably to the company.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, what happens a lot of times is that due to pressures and due to senior management not wanting to have enough time to refactor things, code bases can sort of stagnate and become more and more complicated just because nobody wants to take that hit and spend 2 to 4 weeks refactoring the code base, not producing any new features. And it's endemic in the industry. There's very few companies that have a handle on this. And I won't name names, but...
I feel quite lucky. I mean, I've only worked on one React code base for a long period of time at the company that I'm at now, but I feel lucky in that they're big advocates of unit testing at my company. And I know that there are trade-offs, right? And, you know, some people might say if you do spend time writing tests, then, you know, it's going to take longer to develop. But what it does mean for us is that if we do want to refactor something, we have a good base to do it because we have quite good test coverage for unit tests and selenium tests and things like that. So if we need to refactor things and simplify things, we can do it. So yeah, I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah, I want to say that one of the most difficult challenges I've actually done with is actually React unit testing and enzyme. It's really, really complicated to unit test this stuff. Just personally speaking, you know.
What does enzyme do? What does enzyme do?
So enzyme allows you to sort of take React and make it run in a sort of semi-real way by sort of mocking the browser environment, but it allows you to run these tests in a sort of unit test way instead of having a whole browser end-to-end test experience. So enzyme has a lot of different ways to test things. So it has ways where you can do what's called like a shallow render, where you just render a component and you do some properties. Then you have this thing called it's a render method where it renders all the subcomponents, but doesn't do any like things like event handling. When you've got the full mount thing, which will mock all of that plus sort of browser related events, but then it won't actually spin up a browser to do it, so it makes it really powerful. But it's quite difficult to get good at that without actually doing it. It's just one of those things. So that's why, I guess, why a lot of teams don't bother with it.
Yeah, I think we use the I can't remember the name of it. We use the default. I think there's a default testing library.
Jest. Yeah.
No, not Jest. There's a default testing library that React comes with.
Testing library.
And maybe it's React testing library. I mean, I didn't set this up, but we have that, and we use Cucumber as well. And I won't get into the details, but we use that and we use Cucumber and we use Selenium tests on the front end as well. So, you know, just to pretend to be a human and, you know, like click the buttons on a page and do the login and stuff. But I agree with you. Like the testing aspect is probably the hardest part, especially if you're trying to work out how to test something that's unfamiliar to you. You know, if you're not sure how to do something, if you're learning to do something new and testing it at the same time, like it can be really hard. So yeah, I've got a lot to learn about that as well.
That sounds like a great work environment for you to be in after only 3 years as a developer, professional developer.
Yeah, I feel really lucky. I feel really lucky. I mean, when I was looking for this job, what interested me is the fact that we use React on the front end and we do Java on the back end. And it's like, oh yeah, I think I want to try and be full stack. And then I got there and I realized, you know, just how complex the front end is alone.
Yeah.
Right?
100%.
You know? And And, you know, the back end has its own complexity as well. You know, so I was just like, you know, there's no chance I'm going to be full stack here. And to be honest, there's only a few people at the company who would, you know, who would do both, really, the back end and the front end. But for the most part, there's a front end team and a back end team, and we all just kind of work in our areas, and it works well, you know. Yeah, it's a great environment.
So what, when you first started learning to code, what were your other recruitment friends telling you?
To be honest, like, I probably told my friends outside of recruitment more, because like, recruitment's quite a cutthroat industry, and I kind of wondered how, like, some other people would react if they kind of knew that I had plans to do something different. You know, I wasn't sure it would be taken in a positive way. So it probably wasn't until, like, right at the end, when I'd started applying for jobs, that I told one or two people that I worked with. So I didn't really have those conversations, to be honest. From my friends outside of recruitment, yeah, they were quite positive and supportive. And my girlfriend was really supportive at the time, and she had to be, because I spent a lot of time at work, and then I'd come home in the evening and be on the laptop for hours, you know. So she needed to be.
Wow, what a special lady!
Yeah,
she could see the. She has a foresight to see that would actually benefit you.
yeah, exactly.
And it's something that very hard for a person to understand. Like, how long is this going to take? You know, what? Because the other person can't see. It's not like you're producing gold bars on the laptop, you know, every 2 hours. It's like something that nobody can. The only thing that's changing is your brain is changing.
I don't even know, to be honest, like, how you could explain what you're doing to someone who doesn't write code. I haven't found a good analogy yet. But she's very patient.
I almost would like to try to get a bunch of recruiters. I don't know why I'm attracted to helping recruiters, but I just feel sorry for them sometimes, because they're talking about tech all day, but they're not actually doing this stuff. And I do think that a technical recruiter would be a very good niche. But I mean, I've tried to help recruiters into this industry, but I just find this very low desire. I mean, I even tried to set up an event in London, and it wasn't a free event, but it was like two to three hours training, and I think I was going to charge something like £20 or £30 each, but I just had like only two people wanted to come to that event. I was just like, sheesh, maybe I should just do a free event for recruiters. But I put that out there, right? If any recruitment company wants, when the lockdown breaks down, then we'll do a two and a half hour free evening for recruiters to set them up in the tech. And we'll just if some company hears this and says, let's do it, and we've got space for, you know, 20 or 30 people, we'll do that and see what happens. But based on my experience, I'm very, very low bar of expectation that I'll actually, even for a free event, people will turn up and go to that. So
yeah, I think there's definitely a space for it. I think recruitment is very hard in its own way, and web development is also very hard, you know. So it can be a challenge to do both, but I think it certainly benefits, you know, recruiters to know a bit more about their, if we're going to call people a product, right, to know a bit more about their product and have more meaningful conversations, you know, with candidates and clients as well, you know. So yeah, there's definitely a big benefit. And to be honest, I saw that as well. As someone who was studying tech and, recruiting at the same time, even though I was, even though it was just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the tech, I felt like my conversations with managers and with candidates, they were a lot more meaningful, you know, and I had some really good relationships in the industry because of that.
Can you sort of quantify that versus when you didn't have that technical experience, how exactly it was different?
I think just being able to ask better questions, you know, like, because you like as a recruiter, you're only going to really have like a high level understanding, you know, like, oh, you know, what is an API, you know, what is a framework, you know. It's hard to remember exactly what those conversations were, but I think just having a high level idea just helps you to be more confident, basically, when you're speaking to people. And if someone said something that was really strange, you could, you know, perhaps challenge them on it, you know. That's what I found at the time.
I would actually like to work as a recruiter for like up to 2 to 3 weeks to see what it's actually like. So if a company's listening to this and I have a quiet spot and you want to hire me for just to see what it's like, you know, we'll do like a 2 or 3 week contract and see how I do.
Yeah. I think as much as programming is something that you can't really understand unless you've done it, recruitment is the same. And I'm sure there's loads of devs who are out there saying, oh, you know, I could do it better. I think you'd learn a lot doing a short gig, and I think you'd enjoy it as well.
Yeah, I can sort of read a technical CV and get a pretty good handle of how the person's going to do. And even just talking to a developer for 5 or 10 minutes, I can immediately tell what kind of level I'm dealing with. And yeah, one of the best hires I've had, when I consult, I have, particularly for startups, they'll ask me to do a bit of recruitment. And I had once two developers come in at like 50K, and then I had a junior guy come in for a junior position and he was wanting like 30K. And he was so much, I wouldn't say like more knowledgeable, but his sort of skill level and like enthusiasm was clearly, he had a passion for the job. And I just says, hire this guy, he's a bargain. And he was at the company for about 2 or 3 years. Fantastic developer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, fantastic developer, yeah.
Nice.
Just that passion, it just blew me away.
Yeah. I think there'd really be a place for someone like that in the recruitment industry, because I think no one wants to make a bad hire, right? You know, so yeah, that'd be really cool.
Cool. So, I guess you're working soon, like myself.
I'm on holiday today.
Oh, okay.
I'm on holiday today. I'm back in the office tomorrow. I'm working from home, and like before the whole lockdown thing, I was in the office more or less every day. So I think I'm in the process of trying to improve my home working setup. You know, instead of working from my dining table, trying to get a desk and get a better chair and stuff like that.
How long was your London commute?
How long was my commute? About an hour.
Wow, you must be loving this working from home.
I do enjoy it, but I think I'll enjoy it more when I have a proper desk and a proper desk and a good chair and a second screen, and once I have a proper setup. And I'm sharing the living room. I won't go into too much detail.
You can get an iPad Pro. iPad Pro will allow you to connect to your like a second screen.
Oh yeah, okay.
And you can just buy like a clip on for the desk, and you don't have to have a full monitor. I'm looking for a good deal on the iPad Pro right now.
Oh yeah, okay. I can check that out. I think once I've improved my work setup, then I'll be a lot happier working from home. But I do wonder, like, in the future, because I know there are many companies who are still reluctant to have people work from home, and I wonder if that will change in the future. I don't actually know why
that's reluctant, because I'm getting more done at home than I am in the office, because I've got that 2 hours of, well, an extra hour and a half of time that I'm not spending commuting, and it's very hard to work when you're on a commute, like in an underground, you know. So.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe if people notice that actually work is getting done and it doesn't matter where people are, then they'll be more accommodating of that sort of thing.
Yeah, and so, if half your workforce is working remote, then it's half the size of an office you need to actually hire out, so...
Yeah, exactly. So I think more work from home is something that I'd like to do.
Cool. So what kind of long-term goals do you have with your software career?
At the moment, I'm trying to just work out how to be a better developer. So maybe another time we'll catch up and I'll pick your brains on what the next step should be. I think while I am more focused on the front end, I am curious. I am curious about learning more things about the web, things like getting better, knowing better things about like web security and and authentication and things like that. Just trying to improve my front end skills, and I'm possibly learning a bit more about like maybe not DevOps, but you know, I think things like continuous integration are becoming are propping up more and more, and I think these days and going forward, even front end developers are going to be expected to know or be able to help out with things in that area. So yeah, just moving forward and trying to stay ahead of the curve, really.
Cool. I sent you a little link to my Svelte Full Stack Starter app there, where you can see how Svelte is used with a Firebase backend, and it's only got a home settings, login, logout, password reset kind of functionality. So that may be a little thing for you to look at. Firebase is not the most simple technology, but it's you don't have to worry about setting up your own dedicated server or managing a Linux box. There's also other examples you can look at, like the real world GitHub series. Mm-hmm. Sorry, it's GitHub. It basically have a mixture of front end and back end technologies.
That sounds awesome. I'll check it out. I mean, if I can ask, what do you do for authentication? Will you just use OAuth, or will you?
I never actually really used OAuth because I couldn't get my head around it very well. I just found that read the documentation. I was like, okay. But I try and stick with basic authentication, username, passwords, and then some sort of encryption with like for unencrypted tokens, like JSON Web Tokens. So you can just leverage to sort of use them to. I just like to keep things simple, because when I go on a website, I often hardly ever use GitHub or LinkedIn to sign in. I'd rather just create a username and password, because when I go to these sites, I can never remember whether I signed up with Twitter or GitHub or Google or whatever.
Yeah,
but if I signed up with a username and password, then I know I've signed up with a username and password, because there's no other option, you know, and password manager will show. So I think social logins is overhyped.
Yeah, I think that sounds like the route that I'd probably go as well. It's complicated enough already as it is.
Yeah, totally. I think OAuth is important if you want to pass authentication around various providers, and you have some complicated sign-in system, then yeah, it's useful. But if you look at some of the technical diagrams, you're talking about 30 steps to log in, like in terms of what's happened to the back end. Maybe the user only sees one or two, but you've seen all these redirects on the website, and there's like the full chart diagrams are like, you need to be a master of this stuff. Security is hard to do. It really is to do well.
Yeah, it is. Fortunately, I don't have to think about it too much. But it's nice to know what's going on.
Okay, mate. Well, Chris, it's been great talking to you.
Yeah. It's thanks for having me. Thanks for having me on the show. And I think if there are any other recruiters who do need some advice about who are thinking of moving into this industry, I'd definitely like to help them as well. So yeah, they can contact me.
We'll do the event together if some company wants to sponsor the location and some pizzas and drinks if they want. We can do a 2 or 3 hour evening where we say like this is this case study here. Chris has done this, and you can teach them some JavaScript.
Yeah, sounds like a plan.
Sorry, I just dumped that on you there.
I'm game for that. Don't worry. Okay. Well, yeah. Good talking to you. And hopefully speak to you soon.
All right, Chris. Thanks for your time.
Yeah. Speak to you soon, Nikos. Take care.
Okay. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. That was Chris Mumba, and really talented guy, ex-recruiter, and he's doing well as a software developer. So hope you enjoy the episode, and we'll see you shortly again on Learn With Us. See you next time. Bye-bye.